Hyperion to a satyr.
Welcome to Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Podcast Network's Hamlet podcast. What is this? Most of the network is about geek culture, like comics, movies, and TV shows, so what gives? Well, this past year, the network has been showing the work of our friend and most recent member, Stella, on a show called Dear Reader, which essentially looked at her favorite book, Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, through the lens of different adaptations. She did an amazing job with it, worth the listen, even if you have only cursory knowledge of the novel. And as soon as I heard the first episode, I threatened, basically, to cover my own favorite work of literature on a podcast, and that's Shakespeare's Hamlet, Prince of Denmark. I want to talk about the text, but like Stella, do it also through the lens of various movie adaptations, Classics Illustrated, there's your geek content, and other works. But I can't do it like Stella. Which is to say, one adaptation at a time. There's just too much to say about the characters and the performances, the staging, etc. in any given adaptation that we'd be here all day. Instead, I will look at Hamlet scene by scene, or scene fragment, because some scenes are just too long for a single episode. In each episode, we'll start by talking about the text itself, what staging and performance problems it poses, what ambiguities have been laid into it, and so on. Then the scene will be discussed through the filter of filmed versions of the play. How did each filmmaker or actor address the play's problems and ambiguities? What effect choices and cuts have on our understanding of the characters and their world? Now, if you search for Hamlet on IMDb, you'll find more than 70 iterations. And that's just for exact title matches. I will not be using them all, obviously. But my sample is still pretty big. In terms of movies, we'll always start with 1996's Kenneth Branagh adaptation, because it uses the integral text, so it's the standard. Clocking in at more than 3.5 hours, this Hamlet makes the characters a lot more ambiguous. Scenes usually cut, even for stage performances, actually make Polonius a lot more sinister than he usually is, just as Claudius, too often the cardboard villain, is more sympathetic. Branagh knows how to entertain, throwing movie stars into the bit parts and making them shine. I'm never bored, despite the length. Then we'll go back in time and proceed chronologically. Laurence Olivier's Oscar-winning interpretation from 1948. Though a black and white from the 40s, this feels like a very modern film using trick photography to get into the title character's head. His Hamlet is no doubt where the modern cliché of the melancholy Hamlet comes from. Such a sad sop in this. Then, the 1980 BBC version, part of the Beeb's complete dramatic works of William Shakespeare, directed by Rodney Bennett and starring Derek Jacobi in the title role. Despite the television look of the production, Jacobi is really quite excellent, tapping more into the trickster Hamlet than others before or after him. It's unfortunate that I didn't feel as positive about Patrick Stewart's Claudius, but he gets a second chance. 1990, Franco Zeffirelli's version, no doubt the most popular, starring Mel Gibson's quite visceral Hamlet. It's a very different interpretation, but it really works. Shame about the various cuts made to the text, however. It's fine for casual viewers as a sort of Braveheart 0.5, but I found the through line to be thoroughly butchered and many characters turned into cliches. Also, I do so hate it when directors go the Freudian route with Hamlet-Gertrude scenes. A decade later, we get Hamlet 2000, Michael Almereyda's Lermanized Hamlet, starring Ethan Hawke as the prince, soliloquizing on his webcam and stalking the halls of the local Blockbuster. It doesn't quite work as well as Romeo plus Juliet, though it's infinitely better acted, and required a lot of moving scenes about, as we'll see. The highlight for me wasn't so much the modern trappings as the performances by people like Bill Murray as Polonius and Sam Shepard as the ghost. Now, you're not going to know this next one, but I'm also using Alexander Fodor's 2007 version. It's another modernization, art house, really. This Hamlet is sometimes clever, sometimes beautiful, sometimes horrifying, and sometimes amateurish. In the final analysis, it doesn't work, but where else will you see a scheming female Polonius and Ophelia high on heroin? The experimentation is taken to an extreme, which is fascinating and certainly worthy of discussion. But this is the only film credit of most participants, and it shows. And finally, there's the 2009 version starring David Tennant and Patrick Stewart based on the stage show directed by Gregory Doran, which uses a stylized contemporary modern dress setting that defies dating. There are modern trappings, but daggers and swords as well. So it is Shakespeare in a manner that today's audiences will understand, a heightened reality, and it quickly became one of my favorite versions. But wait, that's not all. There are two filmic works of interest in which Hamlet is staged as part of the story. Plays within plays, appropriately enough. And we see sizable enough portions of the play to be able to draw discussion from them. These are Slings and Arrows, Season 1. This is a wonderful Canadian comedy that explores both the backstage and the onstage travails of a Shakespearean theater festival. In the first season, not only does the storyline mirror Hamlet's, though we won't get into that, but they must also stage the play with a young Hollywood action star in the title role. Would be worth it just for the smart discussion about staging the play, even if it weren't so damn good. The other is what we call here A Midwinter's Tale. It's a small black and white project by Kenneth Branagh in which a troupe of loser actors must put on Hamlet for Christmas. Hilarity ensues. It's called In the Bleak Midwinter in the UK. That's the proper title. And this gem features a lot of Branagh's regular players. And despite the comedy, the Hamlet that eventually comes out of these oddball thespians has some rather lovely bits. In other media, we will cover comics. I have two classics illustrated stories of Hamlet. One, the original and rather straightforward adaptation from 1955. The other, the fancier 1990 version with more evocative art by Tom Mandrake. I can tell you which I prefer, though neither is truly satisfying. We won't dwell too much on these, but we'll certainly give them their due. And then, a bit of music, and I know this is going to be weird, but French songwriter-composer Johnny Hallyday once wrote a sort of rock opera about Hamlet, available to Francophiles as a 2-CD set. It's at times wonderful, and at others, completely ridiculous. I'll help out with the translations, don't worry. If any particular scene is in one of these adaptations, I'll cover them on that scene's episode. Anything else I want to cover will get its own bonus episode. I'll be doing this by myself for the most part, but it's not impossible that one of those bonus episodes down the line has guests included. As for a release schedule, this show, for the moment, takes advantage of Ryan Daly's hiatus on Cheerscast and will return to fill that hole or others until such a time as I can give it a monthly slot on my schedule. We'll see how it goes and how far we can go before a break is needed. Whether you're a Shakespeare fan or a movie fan, I hope you'll enjoy these one-way discussions and make them two-way by speaking out in our comment section at fireandwaterpodcast.com. I'm particularly interested in how this classic work can be given so many interpretations and how each interpretation can shed new and different light on the bard's masterwork. Literary critics have said that Hamlet is the deepest well ever created in literature, that you can never get to the bottom of it, never draw a single answer from it. I think this little exercise will show that statement to be true. So without further ado, the curtain rises.
Who's there?
Hey, answer me! Stand and unfold yourself!
Long live the king!
Bernardo?
He!
You come most carefully upon your hour.
So Act 1, Scene 1. Every time we start a scene, we should look at the text first. Act 1, Scene 1 is one that's often shortened. Directors tend to cut out Horatio's delivery of the play's historical context, even if it means Fortinbras's arrival at the end comes out of nowhere. I prefer to think of it as building suspense for the appearance of the ghost. But let's get into the words. I will not read the entire scene. If that's something that you want me to do in future episodes, let me know. But I'll be highlighting some lines and how I might interpret them. I mean, scene one, Elsinore, a platform before the castle, Francisco at his post, enter to him Bernardo, another guard. Bernardo says, "Who's there?" Really, that's the whole question of the play. Hamlet is a play about playwriting, about one character's creation of himself as a character. And so the first words, which I always find significant in Shakespeare, even when they're this innocuous, ask the same question the audience is always asking as actors cross the stage. Who's that? Who is this about? And in terms of the rest of the play, it is Hamlet asking himself who he is and who others are. Are they loyal or not? And there's an exchange between Francisco and Bernardo, and there's a changing of the guard, which in itself is interesting because there's a changing of the guard in this kingdom. There's a king, you know, being exchanged for another king. There's a different rulership. And it's really what Hamlet is worried about. The changing of the guard in his mother's bed as well. And eventually, Horatio shows up with Marcellus. Marcellus is another guard. Horatio is Hamlet's best friend from school. And Bernardo says, "What, is Horatio there?" And Horatio answers, "A piece of him." And I like this line a lot. Horatio is an incomplete character without Hamlet. He's the title character's satellite. And without him here, only a piece of him appears. From his point of view, it may be his way of saying that he remains unconvinced of the ghost's existence. He's not going into it with both feet. He's of two minds, and only one of those minds is here. So then the men discuss the ghost's appearance on an earlier night. As they are recounting, as Bernardo recounts this story, the ghost enters. It's classic show don't tell. One of the challenges of directing Hamlet is what to do with the ghost. How supernatural is he? How do you make him appear? And how does the first appearance tie in with his others, especially the problematic one in Gertrude's chamber? If anyone and everyone can see the ghost here, why can't Gertrude see him later? A director can't simply decide that the ghost is a figment of Hamlet's imagination, not without some major cuts. So looking at this scene in films will certainly take note of the effect created by the ghost's appearance. But in the text itself, it's like the characters are suddenly in the flashback. Bernardo starts to tell the story, and then the story sort of happens all over again. So it's in and out for the ghost here, and the characters react, Horatio most of all, because this is the first time he's seen it. And he says, "Before my God, I might not disbelieve without the sensible and true avouch of mine own eyes." In Horatio, we find an outline for Hamlet, linked as they are by both by the friendship, and they have a similar education. He prefigures here Hamlet's attitude towards the ghost, the murder, and everything. He's skeptical. It's the scholar's purview, the true skepticism, the philosophical skepticism. Reducing Horatio to a bit part, as some movies do, actually impairs our understanding of the lead, because they're supposed to be mirrors. They're supposed to be linked. So Horatio's experience is a little bit like Hamlet's. Marcellus asks, "Is it not like the king?" And this is a leitmotif of dead things being like the king. Claudius as Folking is its metaphorical expression, but in tragedy, characters doomed to die can easily be referenced as dead already. When Hamlet dies at the end, it is only after the mantle of leadership has already passed onto him. So this ghost, this dead thing, this undead thing, is it not like the king? We're also talking about the king that's on the throne right now. We're talking about they are brothers, they kind of look alike. So is this thing like the earlier king? Is it not like the current king? And if so, what are the characteristics that they share? So then we get into this long speech that details what's happening in Denmark, what is the historical context. There's a preparation for war, which kind of explains why the guards are maybe so fidgety. There's talk of instability in the realm. And Horatio is the educated one who is well-traveled and who tells us all this. Usually it's the first big cut made to the play. Nevertheless, it serves a function. Not only does it make us wait for the ghost's second appearance, but it tells us who the ghost is, building his legend and thus Hamlet's worthiness as royal successor. We learn how Hamlet Sr. was a warlike king, won some lands from Norway, and now Norway, or young Fortinbras in Norway, wants those lands back. And so there's trouble. If the state is a reflection of its leader, which it almost always is in Shakespeare, then the preparations for war are very much relevant to the idea of an unstable Denmark, and thus an unstable king, an unstable rulership. And they do discuss this as Horatio goes on. And we can understand why filmmakers would want to cut this expository speech out, but nonetheless, especially as text, it's got a lot going for it. The ghost re-enters, they try to speak to it again, Horatio tries to make it speak, the cock crows. So the play starts around midnight, what we get from the text. The ghost appears around maybe 1 a.m., and now the cock crows already. Obviously, it's a theatrical convention, but time speeding by like this is a sign of Denmark being out of joint. Time is out of joint. So maybe this is how Hamlet can be 30 and still a student. Time is out of joint at different points in this play. Is this something a film could play with visually? We'll see if anyone tries it. But the ghost doesn't speak to them, and then it's gone. Final reactions from these guys. I will read a favorite speech of mine. It's Marcellus, who says, "It faded on the crowing of the cock. Some say that ever against that season comes wherein our Savior's birth is celebrated, the birth of dawning singeth all night long. And then, they say, no spirit dares stir abroad, the nights are wholesome. Then no planet strike, no fairy takes, nor witch hath power to charm. So hallowed and so gracious is the time." They're talking about Christmas. They're talking about the birth of Christ. So I guess Hamlet doesn't take place at Christmas. So whatever you do, don't make it Christmassy. It's the dead of winter, but must be well past Christmas. And at the end of the scene, they decide, okay, let's go tell Hamlet about this. Now, they've got Horatio in tow. They've got him in their confidence, and Horatio can more easily get access to Hamlet. Some directors will want to use the trio's retelling of these events in scene 2 to eliminate the scene entirely, perhaps flashing back to them. If so, how do you effectively start the play? So the wedding scene, it works, and many directors have done it, but it doesn't have the tension inherent in scene 1's opening words. So, chronology be damned, we always start looking at the movies with Branagh's 1996 film because it has the entire text. We'll never miss a line. And since we're talking about this version for the first time, there's a couple things I want to get out of the way. First, the setting. Avoiding the usual medieval Gothic, Branagh sets the action much closer to us in the 19th century Viennese-style palace. This will allow for some interesting mise-en-scene via the Hall of Mirrors later, but more than that, the palace looks less like a grungy old castle and more like what could today be the seat of government. And when we look at this era, we think more readily of political machinations, adding that layer to the play. It's nice to see a snowy Denmark as well. We know from the play it's supposed to be bitter cold, but too rarely are we allowed to see it. Freezing the country over gives us one of those Shakespearean stolen seasons that allow the action of the play to unfold when we know real life would normally intrude. Maybe the roads are snowed in, or, you know, there's less travel during the winter. Symbolically, we have the death of nature following the death of the land's king, Hamlet Sr. More superficially, the oft-used concept of changing the play's time period proves that the story is universal. In terms of casting, the casting is also universal in this one. Branagh does the same thing he did in Much Ado About Nothing, and he casts non-British and non-white actors. Were there many black men and women in Denmark in the time period depicted? I wouldn't know, but then let me ask you this. Were there many people called Francisco and Bernardo in Denmark at any time? Shakespeare has already created a universe that's really multicultural and has little respect for these types of historical details. It's not about recreating medieval Denmark, it's about so much more than that. So, of course, a lot of people took exception to the use of high-profile actors, especially Americans, in various bit parts. But there are two very good reasons why this is a good thing. First, when the play is this long and you're not going to make any cuts, you have to give the public some spectacle. Second, putting a big actor in a small part gives that part more importance. So the much maligned Jack Lemmon, for example, plays Marcellus in this. Like, he doesn't approximate even a period English accent, but Marcellus can so often be second guard from the right. The character deserves more. He's the soldier to Horatio's scholar. And he has that wonderful speech that I just read at the end that also contrasts his beliefs to those of Nicholas Farrell's unbelieving Horatio. An accent or no, I think Lemon offers a great, soulful performance.
Then no planet strike, no fairy takes, nor witch hath power to charm. So hallowed and so gracious is the time.
This is also a scary movie. The play turns the first words into a proper fright for the audience. "Who's there?" is shouted as the older Bernardo jumps the younger Francisco. Is it a test? Is it just paranoia? The soldiers are definitely edgy about something. On the one hand, there is a ghost haunting these parts, scarier for what it might pretend. But on the other, there are preparations being made for war, and the guards are completely out of the loop. They need to ask Horatio. So while the soldiers are simple men who don't know what's happening in the court, they did just guard it, they can still feel something is wrong in the land. And in the play's worldview, that something is wrong with their new king. A line that jumped out at me on this particular viewing is,
"Why such impressive shipwright, whose sore task does not divide the Sunday from the week?"
It's another indication that the new leader has adopted unnatural policies that could raise God's ire, a point that culminates with Horatio's pagan comparison of Denmark with a zombie-filled, perpetually eclipsed Rome.
"The graves stood tenantless, and the sheeted dead did squeak and gibber in the Roman streets."
As for the ghost, there are so many descriptions in the play that it's hard to do anything more than follow them. I do like the idea of matching Hamlet's statue with the appearance of the ghost, with the statue pulling its sword to underscore the first line. Is it the soldier's imagination? In the full text, it can't remain just imagination. It must appear to three people here. While the floating figure effect is fine, what sells the scene is the three men's terrorized reaction. Their fear sends them immediately running, giving the play its first taste of momentum, momentum that helps drive Horatio's long speech. These guys have just seen a ghost, and we'll see one again in a minute, and they never forget that. Horatio, who's seeing it for the first time, even needs a little liquid courage. This is a man who thought he had it all figured out, the learned man, more comfortable with mythology than faith. These things happen in books, not in life. It shakes him to his very core. He's finding out he's a literary character, in a sense, you know. Hamlet is quite self-conscious about its own status as a play, especially to modern ears. The ghost's dramatic device, the night that passes in the space of a scene, and of course, the heightened language all contribute to this effect. To make Horatio's long speech more interesting, Branagh does throw some visuals at us. There's the cannon building, not to be confused with cannon with one N building, something this play has done so much of, and then flashes, side flashes, to young Fortinbras's military campaign. That shows us Rufus Sewell at this point, gives Fortinbras a lot more power. In the play, though he's mentioned on at least three more occasions, he isn't seen until the very end. Here, not only do we get a quick early glimpse of him, he's immediately recognizable. He's a fully realized character. It becomes a lot easier for an audience to now register that information about Fortinbras and contrast him and Hamlet. Just like the title character, he's had a father slain by Hamlet Sr., though perhaps not in such an ignoble way. Like Hamlet, he's a charismatic that surrounds himself with followers, his landless resolutes, not necessarily any more disreputable than some of Hamlet's friends, who is most dreadfully attended. However, unlike Hamlet, Fortinbras is a man of action, what Hamlet might have become had he not been plagued by the author's incredible intellect. And a final note on casting, you know, there's a number of pretty geriatric guards, so that there's more of that out-of-jointness of the timeline. Hamlet's too old to be a student. These guys, you know, Jack Lemmon is too old to be a soldier. So that's my final note on that. Now, let's track back to 1948 and Olivier's version. This one got an Oscar and everything, and for a long time, I think, put its stamp on the Hamlet character. This one is definitely medieval Gothic. That Elsinore is a castle, it's in black and white, it's shadowy. The model castle itself looks like a maze, shrouded in fog, sitting atop a remote cliff. It's a closed and claustrophobic system. Perhaps an image of Hamlet's complex and ultimately unknowable mind, unknowable even to himself. You can perhaps imagine Hamlet walking that mad labyrinth and losing himself and losing his mind. And as we'll see, each time we revisit the 1948 Hamlet, the camera makes a great use of the maze, trolling about, looking for action in this room and that room. Like, we can't quite find Hamlet either. Olivier adds a prologue to the play, a reading of scene 4's Oft It Chances in Particular Men that flashes on the screen. Shakespeare's best constructed plays usually have lines or speeches that hold the argument of the play. This speech, So Oft It Chances in Particular Men, that through some vicious mole of nature in them by o'ergrowth of some complexion, oft breaking down the pales and forts of reason, or by some habit grown too much, that these men, carrying, I say, the stamp of one defect, their virtues else, be they as pure as grace, shall in the general censure take corruption from that particular fault. That speech. Though normally it's about Claudius, it can also be applied to Hamlet. It can actually be applied to any tragic hero. It's the essence of tragedy, the tragic flaw. Olivier then goes on to pronounce the only words in the film not written by Shakespeare.
This is the tragedy of a man who could not make up his mind.
Ouch, no. Not only does this talk down to the audience, I also don't think it's true. It's not that Hamlet can't make up his mind, which is to say that he has multiple choices and can't choose between them. It's that he delays acting on his decision until it's too late. The reasons for that delay can vary from interpretation to interpretation, to which it owes part of its longevity. Olivier's reduction probably frustrates me because I'm a show-don't-tell kind of guy, and we'll have to keep Olivier's argument, Hamlet's indecision, in mind as we go through this film. He also shows us Hamlet high on a stage, perhaps to explain what tragedy means, but let's give him the benefit of the doubt and say it's to link the end and the beginning. Hamlet, as a story, told by Horatio. Finally, we get to the play's actual beginning. Bernardo gives Who's There the same urgency we saw in the Branagh film, but the scene carries far less edginess after that. Bernardo's Long Live the King.
Long live the King.
It lacks the exclamation point. So here hinting at a less than glowing opinion of the new royal Dane. Though the scene is reasonably well played, I do find myself wishing that John Lorry had played Marcellus instead of the tiny role of Francisco. His reading of And I Am Sick at Heart, where he seems to surprise himself with the statement, it creates a kind of mystery. Sadly, there's not enough of a role there to reveal just what kind of character Francisco is. An interesting line reading and that's it. Is this old guard only now noticing that something's changed? Anyway, here comes the ghost. First makes its presence known as a general anxiety among the witnesses. Olivier provides the sound of a heartbeat matched to the beating of the camera's focus. It's quite effective. The effect falls on the line, the bell then beating one. So he keeps the ghost himself shrouded in fog, and to make it creepier still, it seems to sometimes be played by a puppet, certainly when it speaks later. What we have here is a stiff, undead king, obviously decomposing just as the rank garden of Denmark is. There's a high shot of the witnesses at one point, and it provides a clue about the camera's oddly detached, voyeuristic style through the rest of the film. Is the camera the ghost's point of view? In this version, I think it is, which means the ghost is always on stage, and its reactions will provide more grist for the mill. Horatio's reaction to the ghost, aside from freaking out when it approaches, makes him cry out, stay and speak, is much calmer than in Branagh's version. It makes a certain kind of sense that in a play set before the Age of Reason, the supernatural would be easier to accept. Horatio's beliefs aren't shaken to their very core in this interpretation. These are things that happen, and they are not that wondrous strange. Now, unlike Branagh, other filmmakers have made cuts. So what are those cuts here? Norway does not survive Olivier's editing. Just absent. Obviously, the preparations for war are cut, because they usually are, but we also lose any mention of Hamlet Sr.'s role in those former wars. This supports the effect created by the production design that Denmark is isolated to the point of not having much trade with other countries. France and England are still destinations later, obviously, but nothing about this war. Nothing to intimate even that a war might be brewing or could happen. Cutting out Horatio's long speech brings the ghost's two appearances together, so there's only one appearance here. Cuts are further made to the exchanges between the men as the cock crows, with one of Horatio's speeches given over to Bernardo. Horatio is no longer the one that talks about the powers of the cock's song, leaving the old wives' tales to the soldiers. A small change that puts part of Horatio's paganism in Bernardo's mouth.
A cock that is the herald to the morn doth with his lofty and shrill-sounding throat awake the god of day.
And it leaves none of that trait in Horatio in that scene. The references to Rome have been removed, and his before my God, I might not disbelieve, now sounds Christian. Without the uneasiness of a coming war, or the comparison to A Nightmarish Rome, Olivia feels the need to get Marcellus's scene 4 line out right here. Something's rotten in the state of Denmark. Well, I'm not sure the point has been made strongly enough at this point. For the BBC version in 1980, this production is a studio-bound multi-camera affair that almost uses the integral text. There are some cuts, mostly a line here and there, but sometimes more important ones. I won't forget to mention them. So let's set the scene. This version's exterior scenes are particularly minimalist, and yet extremely dramatic. Denmark is presented as a fog-bound, snowy plain with a far-off horizon. An empty studio floor painted white, basically. Bleak is a word that comes to mind, which is certainly appropriate. A luminous but empty background against which shadowy figures are heavily contrasted. The soldiers are somewhat unconvincing, or a little bit too jaded, not all that afraid of the ghost when it appears, or easily recovering from that shock. Marcellus's "It faded on the crowing of the cock" speech is delivered so matter-of-factly, it loses the awe for the supernatural it usually holds. These soldiers are simple people, not thinkers or even folk philosophers. Robert Swan's Horatio plays well this unbeliever who even chuckles at the soldier's claims, and so he's more profoundly disturbed by the ghost's manifestation. Sadly, his Roman Street speech has been cut, neglecting the paganism that comes with studying classical texts, as both he and Hamlet must have done. A couple of lines jumped out at me that make me mistrust Horatio in the role of the chorus here, though the performance is sincere. When identifying the king, one has to wonder if Horatio was ever on the battlefield. As a scholar, it wouldn't seem so, but he knows just how Hamlet Sr. frowned when he smote the poleaxe. That's a very clear detail. The potential answer is in this particular passage.
Whispered can inform me.
Well, that can I, at least the whisper goes so.
I never really thought about the punctuation. It's funny how the stops in a line reading can make you see all sorts of new things. I presumed it was the whisper goes so, colon, our last king whose image even but now appeared to us. But it isn't. The whisper, rumor or story, isn't about the king. It's about Horatio being knowledgeable. I can inform you, or so they say. Is Horatio admitting to being a teller of tall tales, an embellisher, someone who speaks firsthand of things he has only secondhand knowledge of? It could explain his intelligence on the Polack Wars, as well as how he fills in the details of Hamlet's story after the play. Those that would make him out to be a more sinister character can also find a way through these lines. For Shakespeare, it may just be part of his continued juxtaposition of reality and play, a subversion of the story's historical roots. What is true, what isn't? Now, due to the production's technical limits, the ghost is created simply with lighting and Patrick Allen's performance. Sadly, he feels a bit like an armored zombie, shambling across the stage, and that's mostly due to the sound. You can hear the steps and the clinks of the armor from the stage sound, giving altogether too much reality to this creature of the ether. In a sense, and combined with the soldiers' performances, this is a less phantasmagorical Denmark. The ghost is solid, and the people take their superstitions for granted. Now, three things to notice about the staging of the scene. First, the cock actually crows. And for some reason, other films have been loath to include a sound effect. Second, the fog is well used to make the ghost appear in different places as the soldiers shout, "'Tis here!" creating a confusion that would not be so easy to produce on stage, unless maybe you had multiple actors doing the ghost, which isn't a bad idea. And third, the transition between this scene and the next. You have applause from the wedding scene overlapping the end of scene one. It's a little jarring, but I think it's appropriate. It reminds you that this is theater. It does make it seem like the director is giving his first scene an ovation, though. The other famous Hamlet is Zeffirelli's 1990 version, or the Mel Gibson Hamlet, and this one is set in an authentic medieval castle, or rather, the ruins of one. Though the place must have been a lot more vibrant in its heyday, using the location pretty much as is, gives us the rotten Denmark of the play. There is a prologue this time. The story begins with what must be 2 months hence, with Hamlet Sr.'s burial. Instead of Horatio and the soldiers, the first characters we meet are the principals. Hamlet, Claudius, Gertrude, and Polonius, four characters marked for death. It is thematically fitting that we first see them in a tomb, mostly silent, and the scene gives the actors a chance to present their characters physically. Hamlet is already a watcher. Claudius is imperious and domineering. Polonius is already noticing a problem with Hamlet's melancholy. Gertrude is all tears, as the play later tells us, but she also gives Claudius an odd look. Does she suspect? Not according to later scenes. Is it guilt from perhaps an affair she's been having with her husband's obviously younger brother? The play does infer a relationship there with Hamlet Sr. off to the wars a good part of the time. Not that we hear much about this in this version. And then the hasty marriage. Or is it simply a response to his look of mine, all mine, that makes her realize she must make a political move if she's to survive? Now, this prologue does borrow a few lines from later in the play. Think of us as a father, stating very early on that Hamlet is next in line. It works as the first line of the play, presenting us at once with the story of a lost and replaced father and the idea that Hamlet's own rise to power has been momentarily usurped. In effect, not only has Claudius replaced Hamlet Sr., but he's also taken Hamlet Jr.'s place. I'll discuss the casting when these characters get a proper scene. So, is there an Act 1, Scene 1? No, it's completely cut from the film. We do not meet Horatio and the soldiers until the end of scene 2, when they come to tell Hamlet of the previous night's apparition. It's a natural cut, since the scene is recounted anyway, but it does remove some elements from the play. Once again, we have an apolitical Denmark that doesn't necessarily seem unstable, and Horatio's role is cut down terribly. So there's little to learn about Hamlet's attitude through him. An interesting take is Hamlet 2000. It takes the Romeo plus Juliet route of Baz Luhrmann, setting the play in modern times, shuffling words around to make it all make sense in a world without swords and royalty. The film sets Hamlet in millennial New York, and right away, we're told via captions that the king and CEO of the Denmark Corporation is dead. So the filmmaker's solution is to equate power with power, corporations as nations, wherein the true power may well lie today. This solves a number of problems with adapting the text for the modern era. Denmark will be the name of the family-controlled company, something to be inherited as much as a throne, and something to kill for. Power, money, women. The head of a company has advisors, Polonius, security, the guards, and a base of operations, in this case, Hotel Elsinore. The captions further reveal that the new CEO, called King in a media-savvy kind of way, has hastily married his brother's widow and that Hamlet has returned from school suspecting foul play. This is new information. Now, it's entirely possible to interpret the play that way if simply based on the line, "My prophetic soul." Hamlet does not necessarily suspect murder until it's revealed to him by the ghost. Of course, foul play may speak to adultery as much as murder, but that still informs Hamlet's frame of mind. He's not just grieving for his father's death, he suspects and is thus extremely resentful of both his mother and stepfather. Ethan Hawke's Hamlet is thus an angry young man, somewhat passive-aggressive. In modern terms, he's emo. But this is all prologue, and this prelude, we're also introduced to a device to modernize Hamlet's soliloquies, video diaries. Less the scholar-warrior that a student might represent in medieval and Renaissance settings, this Hamlet is an artist. He uses video montage to express his ideas. These make liberal use of autoportrait, but also include ironic footage from secondary sources and, of course, text from the soliloquies over the action. The prologue uses a speech displaced from Act 2, Scene 2, on the qualities of man, the paragon of animals. It fits as an introduction to Hamlet's emotional state, more true than in the original scene, where "I have of late, but wherefore I know not." Normally, it's disingenuous. But it's presenting a Hamlet that is far more isolated, or dreadfully attended, since we're already quoting from that scene, than in the standard play. If the modern world tends to isolate people more than ever before, then an isolated Hamlet goes inside himself, a strong image of the soliloquies, only expressing his true self in the digital world, an encoded fashion at that. And it's telling that he's shown watching his own work. There are very few instances where he would allow others to see it. From the video to static, from static to the title card Hamlet in bold letters over a red background, and then off to the wedding scene. So, is there a scene one? It does exist in abbreviated form as a flashback interwoven with the end of scene two, as Horatio and his girlfriend Marcella, Marcellus changes gender in this one, when they tell the story of the ghost, we see snippets from the scene as written. Horatio, Marcella, and security guard Bernardo see the ghost on a security monitor, riding an elevator up from hell. They follow it to another floor, and Horatio tries to speak to it, and the ghost disappears. That's pretty much the extent of it. Fewer than 7 lines in total survive. The trio reduce the bit parts, increase Hamlet's isolation, but they do remove the soldier-scholar contrast that could otherwise exist. But this isn't a martial world, so soldiers would have been out of place. The ghost is played by the great Sam Shepard. It seems a mix of solid and intangible, obviously leaning on a wall, wary, in his frumpy trench coat, and yet walking right through a soda machine as he goes transparent. It's a Pepsi One machine, and it shows through him. That's an intriguing image. I'm not sure what it's meant to portray. One king, first king, scene one. Is it simply an allusion to the Coke Pepsi taste test? Hyperion to Satyr, Hamlet Senior to Claudius, Coke to Pepsi. I'll let the viewer decide. Another modernized Hamlet is Alexander Fodor's Hamlet from 2007. It's billed as Shakespeare in the extreme, which basically means it's highly experimental, it's made on the cheap, and at times it doesn't work at all. And yet, there's a lot of interesting stuff in here. Act 1, Scene 1 isn't used, leaving a gender-swapped Horatio to tell the tale at the wedding banquet, but we do get a ghost scene as a prologue. It's a scene that reappears later and that I will explore more fully in its proper context. It's Ophelia's death. In this modernization, she drowns not in a river, but in her own euphoria as what appears to be a heroin overdose. The ghost appears to us, if not to her, as soon as she's injected herself with the potent opiate. This is part of the film's use of horror, taking the ghost story to its next obvious level with horror, lighting, and mood to match, simple effects that are nonetheless unnerving. What is the ghost doing there? Well, if she dies, seeing a native of the afterlife isn't too surprising, but because he appears earlier, it may be that he is a hallucination. Is the entire play then a hallucination at death's door? Is everything in Hamlet to be filtered through Ophelia's dementia? This interpretation makes everything before her madness suspect, and everything after it a dream. Ophelia as narrator has potential, but she's less reliable than even Horatio. The scene makes us plunge into the surreal universe of the film, and in a sense, it may excuse any of its extremes. Whether Ophelia is meant to be the narrative filter or not, this is a Hamlet where the ghost is a lot more prominent. He's often seen lurking, he's observing the family as it descends into its own decadent hell. Though the scene is pulled from later in the play, Fodor still gives us a ghostly appearance to start off the story. Ophelia replaces Horatio and the soldiers, and doesn't live to tell what she saw, but the feeling is much the same for the audience. As with Hamlet 2000, Elsinore seems to be a hotel or an estate, one that is grubby and in a state of decay. Using what looks like disused buildings works as much to the play's advantage as it does the film's budget. Outside, we can hear seagulls and the sea, though these sometimes seem illusory. If it's daylight, the bright light bleaches everything, as in this scene, and this creates a dreamlike Denmark as much as fog would. Opening credits, indicative of the rest of the film, Fodor uses a number of different ideas in this opening montage. It's not a single concept. First, there are scenes from later in the story, which serve to introduce the cast. So on a gender swap Polonia, for example, Hamlet's rash intruding fool line can be heard. And on Ophelia, I shall obey my sister. These are simple revelatory lines about these characters. However, no one else gets this treatment. So the credits also use outtakes where you can sort of hear the director speaking to the actors and footage of actors diving off the pier. It's breaking the fourth wall. I guess that's allowed since Hamlet is very much about being an actor in the world, but it tends to hurt the very thing Fodor was trying to do by throwing us into the deep end with that first scene. It's a green fairy moment, if you will. There are also dramatis persona shots, again, not given to everyone. So the cumulative effect of these is still one of apprehension. The last two shots show a murder and a scare, leaving the viewer in the right frame of mind, I think, to be disturbed by form and content. And there's a song playing over the opening credits. It's You Love Me to Death by Hooverphonic. The song starts with Face Your Fate, and the refrain goes, you love me to death, but death may love you more, which supports the idea that this is Ophelia's take on the story. Or, since she just died, that this is her song. It speaks both to Hamlet's tragic doom and to Ophelia dying because of love. It has a haunting quality, and it isn't too much on the nose, which I appreciate. In 2009, we got the Gregory Doran-directed production of Hamlet. Among those modern trappings is the use of CCTV footage at various points in the television presentation. The director wanted to create a sense of hyper-surveillance that would heighten the play's paranoia, in the same way that Branagh uses a hall of mirrors. We never quite know who's conducting this surveillance. It's an ambiguity that can be frustrating. Sometimes it could be Polonius, but he's not clued in enough about, for example, the stuff with the ghost. A secret police, then, which we, the audience, are a part of, maybe. Another reason to use the CCTV footage is to create the effect of an invisible ghost. When the ghost appears later in scene one, cutting to the CCTV reveals Horatio and the soldiers talking to thin air. Another effect, especially when you consider that the first shots of the telefilm are CCTV, is to create a postmodern Denmark that seems just as foggy and spooky and gray as the more traditional Denmark of the plays. The grainy gray tones give off a sense of cold and dreariness without the elements having to cooperate. For the first few lines of the dialogue, this version of the play gives us a new spin on the words, a spin that plays on the paranoia conveyed by the CCTV. Bernardo relieves the seemingly freaked out Francisco and asks him,
"Have you had quiet, guard?"
He chooses his words well, wondering if Francisco has seen the ghost, but not revealing his knowledge of this apparition. Who's in on the secret? Certainly not Francisco. Bernardo doesn't want to give it away. Though we know what's coming, Shakespeare has indicated suspense was required for this scene. He is the soldiers called the ghost a thing, so as not to give anything away. And when we cut to talk of politics and history, it's only to give us another scare moment when the ghost reappears. Peter de Jersey's Horatio is as good as they come in the role, and not the first black man to be cast as Horatio. The BBC did it back in 1980, for example. I only mention this because I just now realized how this makes Horatio less of a Dane and more of a stranger. Hamlet calls him a stranger in scene 5. It explains why he doesn't know about the Danish customs that Hamlet then has to explain. He studies in Wittenberg, but he isn't from the area, just as Laertes is off to France to be a stranger there. This is, of course, at odds with the line, "I am more an ancient Roman than a Dane." Does he mean to be a Dane by adoption? Cut from this scene are references to Roman history, and Horatio protects himself with a crucifix. So this is a more Christian Horatio, more in line with the philosophies taught at Wittenberg. Again, this is at odds with the ancient Rome line. When the ghost appears, we don't see it. The sequence is shown from the ghost's point of view, with the soldiers and Horatio cowering in fear before him. Again, suspense is prolonged. Horatio then goes into his recent history of the realm, and the ghost appears, this time in camera, a long ways behind the men. On the next edit, he's creeped up very closely in the flash of an eye. Patrick Stewart plays the dual role of the ghost and Claudius in this version, which highlights the concept of the mirroring in the play. And we'll talk about the actual play in a second. Hamlet Sr. and Claudius are two brothers, both fathers to Hamlet, likely to look alike, never share scenes anyway. So the casting is not only possible, but it's a good idea. The strange armor he wears, using modern materials, but respecting the descriptions of it in the text, is an example of how this version exists in a sort of non-temporal Shakespearean reality. And so the stage play is, of course, did not have the CCTV element, but it used lighting and set dressing to achieve similar effects. The stage featured not only a large mirrored background, but a mirrored floor as well. All part of the aforementioned concept of mirroring, though that idea does not truly put across the idea of hyper-surveillance, it does create an unsettling space where actors can be seen from multiple angles at the same time. In that way, the audience does see more than it should, which is a shadow of the same idea. As in this film version, the soldiers used flashlights, torches, to create the lighting themselves. Reflecting in the mirrors, it proved an efficient way to create the chaos of the ghost's appearances, hiding as much as it revealed. And the mirrored floor is also featured in the telefilm, and we'll see it as part of scene 2 and beyond. And that's it really for the filmed versions or the complete film versions. But I do want to address a couple of other ones. First, the show Slings and Arrows, because the show is about the behind the scenes aspect of a theater festival. We don't usually see complete scenes. And yet what we see of the plays is very sensitive to the text and even insightful. So I don't want to skip Slings and Arrows. Note that while I'm not above talking about scenes only shown in rehearsal, I've tried to use Season 1, Episode 6's performance as the standard. I wasn't really expecting Act 1, Scene 1 to make it, but as the play begins, we do get a handful of lines. An early decision of the show's artistic director was to let the text do the work of setting the scene. So you just got black drapes and minimal sets, costumes taken off the rack by the actors, with no concern for period. Speaks to both the power of the text and its universality. The play opens on the character of Cyril, played by Graham Harley, here playing the shivering Francisco, relieved by Frank, Michael Poley, father of Sarah, as Bernardo. Now, these two guys are a classic double act, often acting as a chorus on the show, and in the Hamlet parallels of the first season, standing in less for Rosencrantz and Guildenstern than for the Gravediggers. In the company at New Burbage, the reality of the show, they are career thespians who play all those bit parts, often more than one per play. It's very fitting that they would open this version of Hamlet because they also open Slings and Arrows itself with a juicy tune played at a rap party. And yet, for clowns, they give an excellent performance in their Scene 1 snippet. When Francisco confirms that the noise he heard is Bernardo, he's quite obviously relieved. No enemy from Norway, no ghost, phew. No, well, we're backstage during the ghost's appearance, so we can't comment on it here, but at this point, maybe he's expecting something worse than certainly the relief of his guard. Which brings up one of those puns Shakespeare's notorious for. For some reason, I never read "for this relief much thanks" as a pun, but there it is in Cyril's performance. It's a bit of a shame that Frank is wearing some sort of Asterix the Gaul costume in those scenes, but otherwise, it's fun. Another play within the play is Kenneth Branagh's A Midwinter's Tale, or A Bleak Midwinter for UK audiences. As with Slings and Arrows, I'll try to focus only on the performance of the play within the movie and not on the rehearsal scenes, which are mostly played for laughs anyway. And that's not to say that the performance doesn't have its own whimsy. Midwinter shows us very short snippets of the scenes, but enough to make a point with the staging. And it uses its black and white film stock to good moody effect. The church, where the play is acted, kind of acts as a natural stage and a gothic setting. Though in the first scene, it's filled with thick fog that tends to linger in the close space. One thing this staging of the play isn't is easy on the audience. And I don't mean us, I mean the people in the room. A reasonable effect you'd want to achieve, probably. Despite the medieval feel of the church, the costumes are World War era, and so Bernardo walks on stage with a machine gun he fires over the audience's heads as they all crouch in fear. Shakespeare has a knack for waking up the audience with the play's opening words, but who's there has never been so shocking. This is a Denmark so unstable, it might shoot you first and ask questions later. Sure, it's played for comedy, but it still offers potable staging if you were to do it yourself. If we look at other media, I really want to talk about the two classics illustrated versions of Hamlet. It wasn't just adapted for the screen. So the original Classics Illustrated was a comic book series designed to go into school libraries and, to be frank, was aimed at boys. The focus on the more adventurous aspects of the literary tales, adapted through its long run, really bear this out. Hamlet appeared in issue 99 and was illustrated by Alex A. Blum. Though it was first published in 1952, Classics Illustrated often went through multiple editions to keep them in print and in the hands of young readers. As an example of how the original series focused on a boy's sensibilities, the soldiers and ghosts of the opening scene are spared five pages. Five whole pages, but then there's no following wedding banquet. So, in 1990, Berkeley Publishing and First Comics resurrected Classics Illustrated for a shorter but much more mature run. These prestige format books had glossy paper and painted artwork and featured some of the best artists of the time, from Bill Sienkiewicz to Cal Baker to Peter Cooper. Hamlet was book 5 and was adapted by writer Stephen Grant and artist Tom Mandrake, the latter whose work on The Spectre made him no stranger to ghostly revenge stories. What can we learn from the original? Well, it's meant to introduce kids to great works, but in the comic book idiom. So Classics Illustrated often starts with a splash page introduction before getting into the story. Hamlet thus begins with a quick presentation of the premise, the father's death, the hasty marriage, and Hamlet's melancholy, then on with the play. The dialogue, though a lot of it is cut, is Shakespeare's. The narration and footnotes help the younger reader understand the action better. It's really a stiff adaptation, sticking to the facts of the action. Obviously, Horatio's historical context is cut, combining the ghost scenes in a way that makes its appearances and disappearances more frenetic. The ghost is larger than life and intangible. It looks like rain or steam or like he's being beamed up. So a lot of cross-hatching, vertical. The adaptation is only really intriguing for its focus on heroics. What is Hamlet like if action and the supernatural are emphasized? As for the Berkeley version, the first caption reads, "Ancient Denmark," setting the play in a no man's land that is more Beowulf than it is Middle Ages. So we have Bernardo in furs, and the characters have oddly shaped word balloons, like in a diamond shaped, which creates an atmospheric Denmark out of time. And of course, there's no one like Tom Mandrake to put fear in a character's eyes. There's a wateriness there. So far as the mood goes, it is achieved by page one. The ghost is a steaming warrior with glowing eyes that tends to blend in with Mandrake's watercolors quite efficiently. What we have in the Berkeley series is a Classics Illustrated for fans of literature rather than fans of comics, although ultimately its audience is probably both. The focus is not on the facts of the story, which is correct, since plot is not Shakespeare's focus either, but on mood and rendering of themes. Though Hamlet is not as abstract as, say, Sienkiewicz's adaptation of Moby Dick, it's still highly expressionistic, marrying visuals to the emotion of the scene. And finally, and this is an odd one, I realize, I want to talk about the French rock opera by Johnny Hallyday. So in 1976, some would say, at the height of his popularity, France's Elvis Presley, Johnny Hallyday, produced a studio double album based on Hamlet. This was like a 6 years in the making project. He hoped to make it a full-blown rock opera for the stage, but its commercial failure sealed its fate. With time, it's gotten more respect, I think, but it's still an oddity, both in Hallyday's discography and in the world of Hamlet adaptations. And I'll play a little clips of it. Even though you probably can't understand the language unless you're up on your French, you'll get a sense of what it sounds like, at least. For Act 1, Scene 1, we're concerned with the first two tracks. The first is a musical overture, just to get you in the mood, and it sounds a little bit like this. And then comes a prologue, basically an introduction to the project.
J'ai aimé l'histoire d'Hamlet. Je ne sais pas exactement pourquoi.
So to translate it, he says, I liked Hamlet's story. I'm not sure why exactly. There are certainly reasons, profound reasons, but it's not important. I will tell you this story as I felt it, me, and you will feel the way you want to, you. So it's a personal vision, but not an expert one, and admittedly not an expert one. Hallyday doesn't make himself out to be something he's not. And yet, I do think he could be a little more committal about that vision. But since Hamlet is often anything you want it, him to be, it's not necessarily the wrong attitude. There is no scene one. The story starts with Hamlet's first speech, which explains the context of the story anyway. So no dancing soldiers with Horatio intoning Speak to Me or some similar song. That might be fun. And we'll return to the rock opera when songs actually match up to the scenes. And that was Act 1, Scene 1. Next time, we'll crash Claudius's and Gertrude's wedding banquet. If you have thoughts on this particular episode, please head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com and put keyboard to digital paper. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/fwpodcasts. Thanks again, Stella, for the kick in the pants. And I hope you, dear listener, will return for Act 1, Scene 2.
Is silence.